In memory of Oscar, Oscar's mum Amelia is a listener and patron of Time to Talk TFMR.
This podcast is supported by ARC, Antenatal Results and Choices. ARC is the only UK nationwide charity offering non-directive, individualised information and support to parents who are making decisions around antenatal screening and diagnostic testing. They also provide specialised bereavement care for those who experience termination for medical reasons. For more information or support, please call ARC on 0207 713 7486.
Hello and welcome to Time to Talk TFMR, Termination for Medical Reasons. I'm Hayley, and today we're talking with Jane Fisher, the Director of Antenatal Results and Choices, and Professor of Psychology Caroline Lafarge from the University of West London. We're talking about the research into TFMR and specifically terminating for fetal abnormality. What research is out there, and how does it help shape our understanding? And how does it inform the healthcare professionals helping women? So welcome, Jane and Caroline. It's lovely to have you here.
Hi, Hayley.
Hello.
So Caroline, I thought maybe we'd start with you and just maybe tell us a bit about what brought you to be studying the impacts of termination for fetal abnormality, because that is very specific in your research.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, thank you. Well, I had a termination for fetal abnormality back in 2007. My baby, I think I was 28 weeks pregnant. The baby had brain abnormalities. And that was diagnosed, well, there was a suspicion after the second scan, so about 20 weeks. So it took a long time to get a diagnosis because typically with brain abnormality, you know, you have to see all that. Or they change over time before they can sanction anything. So we waited for about 8 weeks of tests, retests, and MRI, and all that sort of thing. And yeah, week 28, we were told that it looked pretty bad, basically. So our determination, which obviously I found it very difficult, I would say we were quite satisfied that we've made the right decision, but nonetheless, you know,
yeah.
A decision you want to make. So it sort of really influenced the next part of my life. I was actually at the time already sort of retraining in psychology. And that kind of prompted me to really look at it in a different way. So I did retrain. And then when I did my master in health psychology, you know, I had to do a topic. And I just thought, well, I know exactly what I want to do. Mm. I want to do something on how women cope with these kind of things, because there was a lot of literature about the trauma and the grief and everything, but not much on actually what's happening in terms of coping processes. So by then, I had the chance to meet Jane and her team, because unfortunately, at the time of my termination, I was not aware of ARC straight away. Mm. I became aware later. And I just thought, brilliant. And I asked Jane if I could maybe recruit participants from ARC. And Jane has been a big supporter. I mean, ARC has been a big supporter of my research from the start. And I think, you know, it's enabled me to do that master's and then to go on and do a PhD exactly on that topic. And yeah, I mean, in the meantime, I was also for a few years a befriender for ARC, so taking calls from parents, which I found really touching and worthwhile. It was really a nice connection with people, mm. and even with men. Some men called as well, not knowing what to do with their partner. And so that was really, really quite special. And yeah, and here I am, you know, it's 14 years later. I've dedicated, yeah, the last 10, 12 years researching termination of pregnancy for fetal abnormality. And I don't regret it at all.
Yeah.
So that's what brought me to look into it, my personal experience, and also this wish to really help other women, because I felt, you know, if ARC wasn't there, that's absolutely nothing for women or couples. And yeah, just spreading the word of what it is. I felt it was badly understood, very stigma bearing still.
Yes.
So, yeah, that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing because I've done a little bit of sort of looking around to see what's out there, and your research is really the primary stuff, you know, and of the most recent as well. And there's a part in one of your papers, and I've put it out there on our social media, and it was the finding that termination for fetal abnormality is 3 times more common than stillbirth and neonatal death combined. Yeah. And it was such a there it is in black and white, how common it is in comparison to these other two that we hear more about when we're talking about baby loss and pregnancy loss. And yet it's so silent. And so when I took that little bit and put it onto social media, just sort of quoted it and didn't say anything else other than just read that a few times. And I mean, people were just, wow, you know, people who have been through it, and they just gone, wow.
Yeah, it's unfortunately a relatively common experience, and we don't talk about it at all. And we know that the figures are also underestimated, especially in the UK. We know that because, you know, for all those termination that happened before, you know, the 24 weeks gestation threshold, maybe on ground C instead of ground E. It is something that happens to quite a few people, a lot of couples, and yet is totally, as you say, hidden. And it's very complex. And I think the more I looked into it, the more complex I realized the experiences at an individual level, but also the way those experiences are shaped by your macro environment, you know, policies, professional practices. Also because I looked at France and England at some point, and they may have some kind of similar practices, but the attitude towards termination is quite different. I always remember doing some observation in a hospital, and this health professional said, oh, well, for these kind of things, you know, we tend to recommend people to go to France because they terminate for this kind of condition later in pregnancy than in the UK. So, you know, if you think about that, you know, the experience of the person is going to be really reflective, but shaped also by what's going on around them.
Yes.
With laws and frameworks. So.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is really fascinating. And I wondered, you know, Jane, bringing you in here, because Caroline just said that, you know, ARC has been very supportive. What has been important for ARC? What did you see in this?
Yeah, I think we've always known there's been very little research into this area. There's more research into other areas of pregnancy and baby loss. And often on social media, you'll see us when there are questions out there to get people to participate in research around pregnancy loss. We'll be saying, oh, what about people who've had terminations after a diagnosis? Are you including them? Because often they're overlooked. And we all know it's so important that we learn more about this experience, both for the parents that go through it, so they can somehow have what they're experiencing validated. And in terms of Caroline's work around coping strategies, perhaps find out what might be helpful to them in moving forward from this, in managing the experience, etc. And secondly, and really important too, it informs practice. It informs health professionals, counsellors, everybody out there, what might be helpful to these women and couples. What are they looking for from the people caring for them? And I was really lucky to work with Caroline, and she always amazes me, Caroline, because you may sense from her tiny bit of accent, because her English is almost perfect, that she's French, and she does all this research in a second language, so hats off for that. But also, she's a very brilliant researcher. She won't tell you that she's won prizes for the work she's done. So we've been really lucky to be able to collaborate. And one thing we did do, getting off about 10 years ago now, was some research on choice of method, because we recognized at ARC that there was a difficulty for those women who wanted to access surgical termination of pregnancy. And it was very hard. We could talk about this to healthcare professionals, but particularly, I have to say, clinicians and doctors, although they'll nod and say, oh, yes, it's a real worry, they won't really take a small charity seriously. What they want, and they're right in a way, is evidence. And so we were able to go away and do some work, questionnaires for people, put together 2 papers, one with the stats that doctors always like, and one on the more qualitative aspects of care. And I think these were really important, both papers, in starting to change hearts and minds. And although we're not there yet, I think more doctors and health professionals are much more open to the idea that choice of method is important. We need to improve the situation. So, yeah, I can't say how important it is that we're able to do this work, and thank Caroline too for all she's helped us to achieve.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe we should just explain, because people, I mean, I've only just really learned the difference between what is quantitative research and what is qualitative research. So, Caroline, do you want to just explain that?
Well, quantitative research, you're looking at numbers, basically, so stats. So you may want to test an hypothesis, and you're going to do a questionnaire with X, maybe 100 participants, and you're looking at result in terms of averages and percentages. So it's very effective to know questions such as how many people do this or that or the other. Is a treatment effective? So quantitative research can answer that kind of things. But what it cannot answer is things more about why is treatment effective, or what it is that people really want, and how do they really experience the care they receive, for example. And for that, you need something more qualitative, where you interview people, and actually the analysis is based on their feedback, and it's word-based analysis. So a bit softer, but nonetheless done extremely rigorously, and they kind of complement each other. Yeah. So the project that Jane was talking about, you know, we had a database where we could do statistics, and actually I think it showed that only, I think it was 18 or 14% of women were offered a choice of method, which goes completely against the guidelines and recommendation. So, you know, you can quantify that. And then we looked at the more qualitative feedback in the other paper, saying, okay, what is important to you in terms of care? And it's things like, you know, care being timely, compassionate care, but a care that also enabled women to make choices. And that came very strong in that study. So you can't get that from the stats. So you've got to have both.
Yeah. So it's having the numbers and then having the stories with that.
Yeah.
And then taking that to clinicians, doctors, midwives, whoever is working with these women and couples, being able to say, here is your sort of proof, for lack of a better term, or here is what's really needed. And yeah, I mean, this is what helps change policy, is what I'm hearing, you know, helps people to change practice.
Yeah, and maybe what I should have added actually at the outset is that ARC started, many of your listeners may know, as under a different name. We started as a charity in the mid-80s called SAFA, Support After Termination for Fetal Abnormality. And we were started by a group of parents bereaved after this experience, and this is really key, I think, a group of health professionals who recognised that their emotional practical needs weren't being met.
Right.
And so at the outset, those professionals helped shape things, along with the fact that one of the women who started the organization happened to be a social scientist herself, Helen Statham, who helped to generate some research around termination, which in turn informed the handbook, the booklet we were able to provide to women and couples at early stages of the charity's existence. Again, made a real difference in how care was delivered, because suddenly professionals recognized some of the things that women really valued and needed in relation to their care. So really from our earliest days, research has been incredibly important to us.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense, doesn't it? You know, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was like, why is research important? This is why it's important. It helps to inform practice. It helps to, you know, ensure people are receiving the care that they need and want and deserve. And, you know, healthcare professionals go into this to help people. And so they need the tools as well to know what they can do to make this process, this experience, I want to say good, but that's not the right word. It's the sort of copable. And, you know, you talked about coping strategies, and I guess I'm really interested to find out, what did you find, Caroline? You know, what coping strategies were brought in?
Yes, I mean, I've looked at it from a qualitative point and as well of a quantitative stance as well. So questionnaires, but also interviews. And what I found is there was kind of four big groups of coping strategies that women used. One was support. And in a way, because I recruited from a support organization, that's maybe not surprising that support was so strong. So, you know, that's the limitation of the design in a way, but, you know. Receiving support was extremely important, whether it's from health professional, family, and we know how difficult it is with family sometimes, not necessarily at the time of the procedure, but later on. We know people grieve differently, and I can bring all sorts of issues as well. But support is very important. But interestingly, giving support to others was also very important. So as a way to cope, being useful, sharing knowledge, and supporting others was also a way women found very useful to kind of deal with what was happening to them. It's almost like, you know, it didn't happen in vain. I'm doing something positive with it. The other coping structure was to do with acceptance. So women were more able to talk about the experience, maybe recognizing, naming the baby, having a funeral, whichever way it was usually quite a good way for the family to adjust to, because I've also looked at, and I'll talk to you in a minute, but what kind of promote a better psychological adjustment. But being able to accept, you know, talking about the baby, having memory boxes, that sort of thing is really helpful. And in the same way, on the other side of that, you also have a way of coping, which is more about avoidance. So distracting yourself, going back to work very quickly after. And sometimes people may say yes, but, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, it's kind of hiding from the problem. Mm. Well, yes and no, because sometimes you do need, you know, for some people, it gives them the time they need to figure out actually what kind of coping strategy may be more useful. So it's almost could be like a pause button where they resume their life and figure out how the rest is going to happen. Mm. So it's often kind of avoidant coping strategy get bad press because it's not supposed to be very adaptive long term. But actually, you know, sometimes it's helpful.
It gets you through those early days, doesn't it? Or weeks or months.
You know, it enables you to stand up on your two feet. Mm. That's, you know, that's useful. And the other coping strategy that type is about making meaning making. So people were able to make sense of what happened to them in some ways, whether it's to do with changing career, maybe it's to do with, you know, raising money for charity, you know, different types of life perspective. All of that was really, really helpful for people. And from all of them, the one that when we measured, you know, levels of grief and levels of coping strategies, the two one that really promote better psychological well-being were acceptance and positive reframing. So this idea that you can look at things and say, okay, this happened, but perhaps I can look at it in a slightly different way. Obviously, not straight away.
No.
You need time for that. And on the other side, what didn't help was a lot of self-blame, which makes sense in a way, and actually disengaging from the process, so not wanting to have much to do in the long term.
Right.
So that's the kind of thing. And you know, if you take those findings, there are things we can do to promote acceptance. There are things we can do to promote, you know, looking at things in a slightly different ways, if that's useful. Yeah, so things like, you know, intervention based on CBT or other type of things could be very helpful for that. Compassionate focused therapy could be a really good intervention.
Yeah. I mean, I'm really interested in, I mean, I know that that's part of your interest as well, that maternal health, this is what you're doing. This is what this research is for. And it's something I'm interested in as well. And I'm sure Jane, you can sort of attest to this because you see people through quite a long part of their journey sometimes. And what I was getting in there is a little bit about post-traumatic growth is another word that is sort of or phrase that is used.
Absolutely.
And, you know, how to help women to survive and thrive and be able to go out in their lives and do just that and be changed forever, but be productive or comfortable or whatever it is that they need, that they have a meaningful life afterwards. Because I really do think that if the care isn't quite right or the support isn't quite right, it can have a long-term detrimental effect. I don't know, Jane, did you want to say anything about what you see in this life cycle of?
Yeah, and well, it happily, it chimes with what Caroline is saying, really, that it is, it's so important often to women to be able to tell their story in some way, whatever way works for them, to be heard and to help them then understand better what went on and come to a place of acceptance. And that's not to say that all women will not have some conflicted feelings over time. That they won't go away necessarily completely, but they'll be manageable. Mm-hmm. They'll be able to look back and say, okay, we were thrown into one of the most horrendous experiences of our lives. It was nightmarish. We did the best we could for our baby. We did the best we could for ourselves in these extraordinarily traumatic times, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. And again, turning back to research, it's really quite moving to me to see when I perhaps put a request into our online forum for people to take part in research, there's always a really good take up. Mm. And people really value being asked about what happened and being able again to tell their story. And that too can help, as Caroline was alluding to, them make meaning.
Yes.
Okay, I'm doing this or my baby so that what happened to us means something. It can perhaps lead to better care for women in the future, better understanding of what we go through. And I always find that really quite moving.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I can really see that. You know, I mean, that's the reason why I'm doing what I'm doing. It's to make meaning and to carry on Luna's legacy. Yeah, it's really important to me. Mm. And I wonder, Caroline, you know, you sort of talked about it, that you got into this research because of your own experience. Yeah. I wondered, you know, for you personally, how it affected your experience, you know, what you got from that.
Hugely, I think, and that's interesting. I think at first it was all about helping, getting this, I wanted people to know about parents' experiences because I felt, you know, it was badly understood. And I think I forgot a little bit my own experience because maybe it was convenient, maybe that's what I needed, you know, so I'm not going to. And it's only after a few years that I thought, hang on, because I'm this kind of spokesperson, but I rarely talk about my experience. And even at work, sometimes people would say, why are you interested in these things? And I didn't necessarily disclose because I thought that's private. I don't want them to know necessarily. And now I think after a while, I just felt I need to reclaim my experience for what it is. And I think part of it, you know, I haven't spoken about it for quite some time, but being able to talk about my experience today is also really, really nice because I can see the blend. And I mean, it's quite some time now. I mean, it's 14 years ago. Mm. But I think you do need at some point to go back and say, okay, what's mine and what's other people's experience? Mm. And I think I've reached that point, you know, a few years ago where it came like a hole and that was really, really soothing. And I say, well, I've done that for my son. And if it's helpful, that's brilliant. You know, I'll carry on. Mm. And the next step for me is very much, and I've been trying to get funding for some time now, to try and get money to develop an intervention to support women and couples. Funding is an issue, especially when it's quite niche. Yeah. But, you know, I'll carry on. I've got quite a lot of ideas. So hopefully, I still feel also that maybe men need a bit of attention as well, a partner. Mm. Yeah, that's something I want to do for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's really good to hear that. That's sort of part of your coping strategy, yeah, was to sort of dive into doing this research.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to sort of see how, you know, people can come around it again and reframe their experience. And also, I think what I was hearing in there is that sometimes it was, you know, I don't want to talk about my experience, you know, so it's like, I need that to be over there and be separate. And yeah. Yeah, and how, you know, how we can do that and move through that. And that it's okay, because I think we hear a lot from women that, you know, they're kind of almost going, I wish I could talk about this like you do, Hayley, for example. And I'm going, it's okay if you can't right now. You know, I'm 5 years down the road now, and it's I'm in a very different place. And then, you know, there might be people that are 14, 15, 20 years down the road, and they still haven't really talked about it too much. So it's kind of this, it's okay. And also finding the places where you can integrate it into your life. And it's complicated. It takes time.
I think trusting your own pace
with
things is really important. That's the one thing I've learned, is that there's no one way, or should do this or should do that, or I should be. No. And, you know, I'm very glad that, you know, maybe I started really looking at other people's experience before I really, but that's my way of doing it, you know. And it worked for me. So, you know, maybe someone has a different way. And I think the research, for me, the key thing is to show that actually there's so many ways of dealing with these things, with this experience. And actually, I remember having one day a call from someone saying, I don't really feel bad about it. Am I normal?
Yeah.
And I thought, well, no, of course you are. And it's, and I'm sure, Jane, you've got that sort of thing where people question whether they're,
Is there something wrong with me, because I'm feeling quite okay with it all? We've heard that too. And it's like, yes, you are absolutely fine. You know what? That is another part of this experience. And I think it's talked about a lot less, that, you know, there might, as well as devastation, of course, there may also be a sort of relief and a bit of that acceptance of like, this really was the right thing. I feel really okay about it.
And a sense of agency as well.
Yes.
Not being able to decide is really important. So,
No, I think that's really worth saying. You know, I'm really aware that, you know, we talk a lot about the grief and the real difficult parts and all that sort of thing. We also need to leave room for those other feelings and experiences within it.
I mean, I just want to chip in and absolutely agree with that. And part of the huge value of Caroline's work is showing us that this is a very individual experience. Because one of the dangers of some types of research is when perhaps the researchers go in with half formulated idea and just want to prove that idea, or their research is taken up as saying, oh, this shows you should. One very good example of that was a paper some years ago about seeing a baby after pregnancy loss. And it wasn't a huge piece of research, but it was suddenly taken up, and taken up by august organizations like NICE, the national body that puts out guidance for clinicians, as, oh, look, research says that women should see their baby after a loss. And of course, so many of us were up in arms and actually did get it changed in the end to say, no, this paper shows for some women it was useful. You can't say from that and generalize that for everybody that goes through a loss, it's going to be the right thing to do. So it's important to interrogate research to see how it's carried out, the numbers involved, and not to use it in a way that ultimately is not necessarily good.
Well, I sort of hear in that it was used as a way of taking away agency and choice.
Exactly.
You know, people, women should never be forced into any of these boxes, and it should always be an open question of, would you like to fill in the blank? And then having the ability to have the conversation around that and the questions they might have or concerns they might have.
And maybe just one more point on that, which goes to people in practice and healthcare professionals, and just recognizing that that is quite challenging for them.
I was saying exactly the same thing as I was saying it.
When it's open, a lot of healthcare professionals, and it's understandable, they want a guidebook. They want, this is what you need to do. This is going to be helpful. They see people in such distress and they desperately want to make things better for them. And so to have something that says, this is what will be good for you, this will make it slightly better, etc., is very attractive. And when we're from research, we're saying, well, actually, that's not going to be the case. You've got to let it come from them and give them agency. That's challenging. So I think the research has to go hand in hand with helping equip health professionals to deliver really high quality care in these difficult circumstances.
Yeah. I mean, what we're asking of our healthcare professionals, and going back to what I said, you know, whatever, a few moments ago about we go with the assumption that everybody who is in a healthcare professional role is there to help people. That's what they want to do, do no harm, help, make things better. But of course, what we're also talking about is a psychological experience that this is not medical model in that sense. This is where the medical is coming into the emotional, and we cannot fix the emotional, what is happening on that emotional plane and spiritual plane for people. And I think that is the real complicated part of this for healthcare professionals. They've got all their medicines and their tools and their devices, and then none of that is going to work for the emotional part of this.
And they've got their own emotions as well.
And then they've got their own emotions in this as well, of course.
That is really key. I mean, part of my PhD was to look at health professionals' take on how women cope, because I thought if they really don't understand how women experience, then we've got an issue.
Yes.
In terms of training. They did, at the time of termination, they were very cognizant of, they knew how women were experiencing. It's just after. They really didn't know, you know, what happened to women after that. But what came up from those interviews, also the level of emotions that healthcare professionals feel, you know, going and do a feticide. I don't think any healthcare professional relish the idea. And you know, it's a big thing for them as well. And I know there's some papers on that too that were produced. But yeah, it's almost like an exchange of experience, you know, and it goes relatively well when there's really a merging of empathy between the woman and the healthcare professional. And that makes it easier. But it's not always the case, unfortunately.
No.
But sometimes it is, and it's dealt with really well.
Yeah, and I guess you touched on it there, Caroline, that it's the after as well. So, you know, there's all this, and I mean, we hear it. We get the emails and stuff of people get to where they had their termination, and then they kind of go, I thought it would be all over then.
Yeah.
You know, for themselves, they think, well, once I've done that, then it's all over. I can remember feeling this myself and getting home and going, well, now what the hell now? What do I don't even know what to think of this, really. And yeah, and that I was lucky in a lucky place that I had lots of good support people I could pull on in different avenues. I knew how to access that. I knew how to ask for what I needed. You know, not everybody's that so lucky.
Yeah, absolutely. And currently, I mean, you know, ARC is there, and I think it's absolutely invaluable because that's the only place people can turn to. And I mean, I know there's a network or some help available, but really, you know, what do you do with that experience long term? Mm-hmm. And actually, you know, the GPs might not know how to deal with it. That's why something that really, to me, an intervention that builds resources, not necessarily something where, you know, there's a lot of addressing issues necessarily, but maybe something that enable women to feel more equipped to deal with it. And if they need further help later down the line, and of course, being able to access that, but something that kind of this in-between period, I think it's very helpful, would be very helpful.
Yeah. I wanted to just ask you, because I mean, I'm really fascinated by all this research stuff, but I'm a bit of a nerd like that. I appreciate that, you know, not everyone may feel like this, but I think we're in good company right now. But I just wanted to know, was there anything that really surprised you out of your research? Did anything come out that you were like, I did not expect that?
I guess, this aspect of post-traumatic growth, I didn't necessarily expect that because when I started the research, I think I was only a few years down the line of my own experience. And I didn't really know about post-traumatic growth at the time. And it's by reading through the different research, I thought, hang on, there's something more than just pure grief and trauma. And I integrated that later in my research because I thought, hang on, so I didn't start thinking about it, but then I integrated it because I thought, oh, that's interesting. What was interesting also is the complexity about that, because when I researched it, post-traumatic growth didn't come very strongly in terms of ratings. And I thought, why is it? Because we know it's a traumatic experience. And I think there's a complexity about the type of loss, a parent's losing a child that's not born or is in utero, but also the decision-making around that. What's, yeah. Is that acceptable to see any positivity linked to a, you know, so some sort of social desirability bias where people don't feel able or maybe don't really see it in this way. So that was quite surprising because the literature, so I thought, oh, yes, there's something about post-traumatic growth. And then looking into it, it was a lot more complex than it looked. So that was quite surprising. But also this idea of, for some women, it's fine. And yeah, they get on with it, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't quite expect that either, but I thought that was very powerful. The same way, if you don't feel able to say you're feeling fine, then your voice is hidden as well, you know. So I think it's all kind of disenfranchised experience that I didn't expect to see where they were, if you see what I mean.
Yeah,
that's really interesting. Jane, did you, when you were going, reading the research or being alongside it, did anything pop out for you that was surprising you didn't expect?
I can't think of anything. Nothing comes to mind that jumped out, but I think what it did say so clearly, all the research is, as Caroline has said, is the individual and the complex nature of this experience.
Yeah.
The fact that it is different for different women. It is a traumatic, I think generally it's traumatic. I think we can make that point. And it's not a word I feel comfortable using in general, but for this particular experience, I think we can say that. Mm. And how women and couples are able to work it through will depend on all sorts of factors. And for some, because of the complexity and the difficulty, it will act as a kind of catalyst that does mean they struggle more because it brings up all sorts of other things in their lives. But others, as Caroline said, they will manage it in a different way because for whatever reason, they have the inner resources or the relationships to do so. So it all comes down to making sure women couples are enabled to deal with their experience on their own terms. And we recognize it's not going to be a one size fits all by any stretch of the imagination. Mm. It's complicated.
It is complicated. It's one of the most complex topics. And I know, you know, I've experienced it myself, but I think I've maybe said this before on other episodes. It's like, I have my experience. That's my experience. But the hundreds and thousands of different experiences, the different diagnosis, the different procedures, you know, and then that's just about your TFMR. That's just about your termination. And then we all have our different life experience up to that point, who we are and what our view of the world is, and it just combine all that together, and it's a sort of endless storytelling you could do on this topic. It's been great having you both on. I feel like, yeah, I really want to get stuck into the research now and be like reading it all day long. But I might not have time to do all of that, but I'd like to do some more of it for sure. We do one last little thing, and it's called our TFMR takeaways. And Jane, I thought I'd let you sort of do this. I'm going to let you do it this time because I know you've been on a lot of times, but you know, it's been a while and it's a new year and it's a new sort of set of seasons. So we'll let you say your takeaway, which is, what piece of advice or hope would you give to women families who are either facing TFMR or who have undergone a TFMR?
Well, I guess it goes back to something that was said earlier, that there are no shoulds. There are no shoulds about how you should behave or how you should feel. And obviously, you know where we are at ARC should you need extra support. But I guess from my, and it is two decades now of working with women and couples, I can with confidence say the vast majority of people will manage it. For those of you listening to this early in your bereavement, it won't feel like it at the moment, but I can reassure you that things will get better.
Yeah, thank you. And Caroline, what piece of advice or hope?
I think it's trusting yourself in a way that your body, your mind knows when to change gear or when to ask for help. And, you know, we're all expert of our own emotions in some way. So it's recognizing that and being Yeah, trusting yourself through the process, to me, and not to link with what Jane was saying, thinking that there's any way that things should happen at a certain point, or and recognizing when maybe when you need help, I think is important too.
Yeah. Yeah. Taking care of yourself. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you both. It's been a really interesting conversation. Yeah, and I feel like I've got a lot of reading to do.
Actually, can I just finish on one bit of good news?
Yes, please.
It is good news. I'm just happy to say that ARC has got some funding, that we are able to commission some research. So we are going to be using Caroline's expertise again to do some work that we hope will be of benefit to the people listening to this podcast. So that's a little bit of good news to leave you with.
Into what? What is it? What's it going to be? Because Caroline, you kind of alluded to it and then we kind of went away from it. So what, let's
we probably need to talk a bit more. We can't. Oh, this is just a teaser. It's a teaser.
It's a research teaser.
But the good news is it's going to be happening. Yeah, it is. There'll be another episode where we
come back and talk about it.
Exactly. We're angling to come on again, you see.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, we'd love to have you both on again for sure to talk about that. And I'm sure our listeners would be really interested. So yes, thank you so much, both of you. Really appreciate your time. And
Thank you.
We'll speak soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening and we hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. This ensures you get all of our new episodes as soon as they're released and you can find us in most podcasting platforms. Get in touch. We love to hear from you. Find us over on social media, Facebook and Instagram at @TimeToTalkTFMR and Twitter @TalkTFMR. So that's all for this time. Thank you and please take gentle care of yourselves.